Jarek, if you could get us started, I'd like to first ask you to share some background for listeners who may not know what the Point House is or about the revitalization project.
Sure. Well, my name is Jarek Hope Lang. My Tlingit name is Srutin, and I am of the Raven Moiety Kiksati clan from Sitka, Alaska. And this project started out in the most organic way for me, which was I was walking by with the late Bertha Karras from Sitka, Alaska, and we walked by this chunk of property on our way to her house, and she said to me, just casually, that's your people's property and you need to get it back. And at the time, I really had no idea or no concept as to what tied me to that land and what her impression was that I had any business being a part of it. So kind of led me down a rabbit hole to understanding what had been there prior. And then it came to my attention that this was where our clan house had once stood. And a simple statement like that from somebody that you respect can spiderweb in these million ways. And it opened up my mind to the idea that my history used to exist in a physical structure, but far beyond the physical structure, I continue to exist. And I continue identifying from being from that house, even though the structure wasn't there. So it started a decades long work of trying to work towards repatriation of that land. It fell out of clan ownership and actively worked with the people who owned it to see about getting that land back. And that was when I became aware of the land back movement. And I hadn't really conceptualized what land back was and how the healing came from that process until the process started of us acquiring the land back. And I quickly realized that if I was asking for this level of healing on any level, that this needed to involve the long-term care of the property, bettering the property for the next generation, and managing that property in perpetuity. And you have these two real strong dichotomies. You have Western law, which is what we live in, and then you have Tlingit law, which is what we live, what lives inside of us. And I said, somehow or another, there has to be a way to mirror these two things. And so to honor the property, I said, we need to rebuild. Not just structurally, because this is a brick and mortar project, but we need to rebuild spiritually. And there's ideas that tie to that property that I just felt like the time was ripe. I'd never seen a clan house go up in my lifetime. I've seen them come down. I think, Catherine, you know as well as us that the Sitka Indian Village right now has some areas that really need help. And I think I had the permission inside of myself to tell my own story. So what we're hoping to do with the Point House Revitalization Project is build a 21st century clan house that represents Tlingit people in present day. We're also in the process of remodeling a 19th century Kiksati clan house four doors down that can also place us in the past, but let us look towards the future. We worked on Kayashka Hit, which was the late Chuck Miller's. He was the caretaker or Hit Sati for that clan house. We just did some major remodeling as we're moving forward into having his Kuik and celebration of life at the end of the year. So it just seems like now the time is right. And I think young people and elders combined are looking at cultural revitalization with a different lens. So we are looking to break ground sometime in the next year. You know, we're currently working on putting the extant clan houses on the National Register. We got the underrepresented communities grant with the National Park Service. We're looking at shifting the idea of historic preservation within our own community and tying that to Tlingit values. So we have a lot going on. And we started last year with this fun fundraiser idea, bringing Portugal the Man, Samantha Crane, Yahtzee, Nicholas Galanin into the fold and asking people, can we do more than just land acknowledgement? Can we say if we get the land back, we still have a responsibility that ties to that? So this show came from this organic idea of like, can we use art and invite the community as a whole in?
Thomas, the tagline on Pink Martini's website is, if the United Nations had a house band. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Well, we're old-fashioned. So if we had the tagline is actually more like if the United Nations had a house band in the year 1962, hopefully we would be that band. And because it's we perform songs in 30 different languages, we're sort of musical diplomats and ambassadors, and sort of believe in the power of bringing people together through through music. And we have a 31-year history of doing this, and we're so delighted to be coming to Alaska to be part of continuing in that tradition.
And going back to that 31-year history, I'm really curious about the origins of Pink Martini. When I was reading a little bit about it, it can be traced back to the Pee Wee Herman Christmas special that you saw. Can you tell me that story?
So, back in 1994, I had just graduated from college, and I thought I was going to go into politics. And so I was working on various political campaigns in Oregon. And in fact, in 1994, there was a nasty attempt to amend the Oregon Constitution to declare homosexuality illegal in the state. And so I was working on the campaign in opposition to this. I had just seen Pee Wee Herman's Christmas special, which has, have you seen the special? 45 minutes of, like, it's unbelievable. He has every guest star imaginable. Dinah Shore, Oprah Winfrey, Whoopi Goldberg, Magic Johnson, Little Richard, Cher, Charo, Katie Lang, Grace Jones, Zsa Zsa Gabor, and the Del Rubio triplets. Three gals, three guitars, somewhere between the ages of 70 and 80. They literally were triplets. They lived in a triple-wide mobile home in San Pedro, California. They wore matching miniskirts, matching booties, and they had huge hair. They played guitar and they sang covers of Walk Like an Egyptian and Whip It. And so I brought them to Portland to do a series of concerts in nursing homes, hospitals, retirement homes, and rotary meetings. And at the end of the set, they would very sweetly say, please vote no on Measure 13. And at the end of the week, we had a big community-wide concert. I needed an opening act, so I threw on a Betsy Johnson cocktail dress and I started the band. That's how it started, 31 years ago. And we then kind of became the house band for political fundraising in Portland. So we did benefits for cleaning up the Willamette River, affordable housing, that kind of thing. We also played a bunch of weddings, most of which ended in fiery divorce. We have a 98% divorce rate. We just played basically in Portland for these political fundraisers, trying to bring breakfast, a little bit of Breakfast at Tiffany's to political fundraising. And then when we released our first album, crazily enough, it became sort of hugely popular in France. And so that began our first career outside of of Portland.
When you put on those first shows, did you envision it getting as big as it did and having as much reach?
The thing is, we were like a band that, it was not like a band that would ever go on the road, get in a cargo van and go hurtling down the road and get stoned. You know, it wasn't that kind of band. It was really sort of old fashioned. So I could never imagine having this band on the road with this many people doing this kind of music. I mean, it just didn't seem plausible. So it was a huge surprise when it sort of took off first in France. And then eventually, went from there. We were very, very lucky. You know, at that time there was press. You know, and people were buying albums. And, I mean, there were a whole bunch of things that were in place that I think, if we were trying to start this band now, it would never happen. And then, of course, there's Storm Large, who really brings everything up 7,000 notches. You haven't played with us in Alaska yet, have you, Storm?
Yes, I have.
Oh, did we?
Yes, I have. Yeah, okay. A long time ago. Yeah, I loved it. It's such a magical spot. I'd always wanted to go to Alaska, and it's a pretty great way to see the state. It's beautiful. So something magical about the light.
And Storm, you joined the band in 2011, right?
Yeah.
And you alternate as the lead singer with China Forbes, but you've mentioned in other interviews that you're really one of 15 soloists. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that looks like?
Well, I'm a I have my own band, and I also perform solo with symphonies and stuff. So when you are the, usually normally in a band, you're the lead singer is sort of the identity, the ID of the band. You're the mouthpiece, you're the person that everyone's kind of looking at. And it's a big responsibility, and it's sort of your identity, as the band's identity is wrapped up with the singer. In Pink Martini, though, each lead singer has a very unique and bold and brilliant, whatever, sparkly personality. It is one of the most relaxing front gigs, because I'll sing a bunch of songs solo, and then I will shimmy back to the backing vocal mic. Jimmy Harrod will step forward. Edna Vasquez will step forward, or it'll be a band solo. A piano with Thomas and his partner, Hunter Nowak, on piano, doing Rhapsody in Blue, the most hilarious physical comedy you've ever seen in your life. It's like laughing, kind of. It's a big variety show, and everybody has an important role in unison. But I see Pink Martini as a collective of wonderful, amazing, brilliant stars in their own right.
So what's it like, though, to travel with such a large band, so many instruments, to these remote places like Sitka and Homer? What's that experience like?
Busy.
Well, right now I feel like the band, everybody is acting so well together. There's a lot of laughter. It's been going on for 31 years, so you would think that at times there have been, people have been deeply exhausted, including mostly me. I think that right now everybody is just so happy with how things are going that it's a pleasure to be on the road.
And so what can Sitka and Juno audiences expect from these upcoming shows, and how can they prepare? Like, what albums should they listen to? You know, what can they kind of get ready for?
Any albums, really. I mean, I hear Pink Martini music all over the world, playing in restaurants, cafes, even in like shopping centers. The albums are polished and beautifully put together. It's very vastly different from the live show. The live show is just it's just a party. So, you know, they don't need to prepare. Just be hydrated, rested, show up with your heart on your sleeve and shoes on your feet, and you're going to dance your butt off. So maybe calorie load. If the audience is showing up with all their heart, it really juices the stage. It juices us, because we're not the kind of band that is like, that we are a band on stage, lit, electrified, amplified, and you are the audience and you sit below in the dark and you receive what we have to offer. It is whatever room we're in a little high school auditorium or a giant or the Hollywood Bowl, huge stadium, everybody's in on it. Everybody is a part of the show, energetically, emotionally. It's fantastic. I think that's part of the secret sauce and why Pink Martini has lasted so long, because it is the ideal situation for, especially nowadays, it's such a radical act of optimism for people to gather like that, different from different backgrounds, different socioeconomic realities, different ethnicities, and all gather together in a room and have a matching emotional experience with their fellow man and their fellow woman. So it's just kind of, it's rad. But the audience is definitely part of it. They're not a separate entity ever. So it's going to be awesome.
You know, this is the second benefit concert. Where did the idea, you know, you said it was organic, come from for using music and concerts and connecting it to this project as an opportunity for fundraising?
I never really realized, A, that I had such an amazing friend group. I'd never pulled from it. I just got to experience it. When I lived amongst them, I just was part of this like community and got to witness their art and their craft. But I never called upon it to benefit me in any way. And I think there's a heavy burden that comes with some of this lifting work, right? It doesn't just happen because you sit back and let it happen. So I guess being firmly rooted in who I am and what I'm trying to do and what I'm trying to accomplish, once you establish your narrative, it's much easier to ask for help because it becomes more of a tangible. So when I reconnected with Thomas in Portland, it was like, well, this, we have this momentum, let's keep it going. I think what Portugal the Man and Samantha and Yatsin provided us was optics, and we want to continue that. And I think it's an unconventional way, right? Last year was like rock and roll and folk and singer-songwriter, and this year bringing Pink Martini into the fold. It really creates this open dialogue of like, we are inviting you. The purchasing of a ticket is an invitation to be a guest in our process. You could be part of this restoration, this regeneration, this restorative practice, which traditionally, I don't think these people were invited to. It used to be different, and maybe people don't like me for that. I don't know. I try not to lose sleep over it, but I think there's an opportunity here that if we're asking for land back and we're asking for ways to revitalize our culture and people, that we can ask for help. So we're giving you a product, and in turn, we're taking the funds from those and we're putting them towards what we feel is valuable to us. So it's wonderful to use art as a mechanism, art and music as a mechanism to invite a broader community in to be part of this supportive process.
Yeah,